international finance law, international bond law. We're going to consider the key legal issues which arise in terms of the design, structure and operation of the core bond transactions, note transactions and commercial paper transactions which are conducted in the international finance area. All of this is dealt with in the chapter provided. We're going to look at the bond markets, bond structures, bond issuance, bond negotiability, bond clearing, euro bonds, and then either state, sovereign or domestic bonds and corporate bonds in further detail. This is one of the most important markets in the world. How do governments, how do the largest companies, smaller companies and even medium-sized companies, how do they all borrow, how do they raise funds? They raise funds in the bond market. This is of absolute crucial importance. It always has been, going way back to ancient Mesopotamian times, all the way up to Roman times, Greek times, medieval times, and then now the post-World War Eurobond market. All governments, all companies need to raise funds. That is how the system works. It's how the economy works. You raise funds, you invest, you build, you raise more funds, you repay the funds, and then you build more. Raise more funds. And it's that cyclic reinvestment that marks the evolution and importance and significance of the modern capital market system that we have. I'll give you more materials on the development of corporate form, on companies, the history of company law and the advantages of the corporate form as it builds into this. What we're focusing on just now is the finance aspects of this and how companies are able to raise massive amounts of fund through the international bond market, the note market and the commercial paper market. The key difference simply is the bonds tend to be long, 20 year plus. Historically they were for fixed interest rates, but then they would replicate the loan market, so you would borrow the same amount in the loan market for the same duration, same period. But you can either do it through a syndicated lending, direct bilateral relationship with a group of banks, or you can do it by embedding the security in the form of a transferable legal security and then selling that into the market as a bond or a debenture. The key difference then is that we have the additional advantages of liquidity and transferability in the bond market that we don't have. That simply means that if you have good credit standing, and if the bond markets are safe and stable and healthy at any point in time, you can almost always raise more money at a cheaper rate on the bond market. And that's why they're so powerful, that's why they're so important. If there's any difficulty with your credit standing, or the deal is slightly more complex for any reason, then you'll go to the bond market, you'll go to the loan market, but generally, you will always try to use the bond market if you can, because you can raise more at finer rates, at better coupon rates. We then explain the nature of the Eurodollar system. The history of the capital market, as we've said, it replicated the early Euro loan market. The first Euro bond was the Otto Strada deal in July 1963. It basically replicates what was happening in the loan market, except the subsequent development of this market is one of shorter duration. We start with long bonds, copying the syndicated loans, but then we get shorter duration. We will come down with medium-term notes, 10 to 15 years, euro notes, 1 to 5 years, and then commercial paper up to 1 year. Historically, chronologically, it jumped from the long bonds down to the short euro notes, then back up to the medium-term notes, simply because these markets and market practice were imported from North America, although we can understand it in terms of long bonds, medium-term notes, shorter euro notes, and then commercial paper up to 1 year. Legally, if it's fixed interest, it's a bond. If it's floating interest, it's a note. We've then got the growth and development of these markets historically, and in particular in the Second World War period. I explain the importance of this, I explain the relevance of this, and how this then supports all of the other key core financial markets that exist, and we'll come back and look at some of the specific variations in further detail, such as floating rate notes, medium-term notes, note issuance facilities, revolving underwriting facilities. All of this is dealt with in the paper. We can consider the history of the bond market, with early issuances going way back to Florence with the Monte Comune in the 1300s. We then had a number of states issuing long-term annuities or even perpetual annuities. This became common, for example, with the Habsburgs in the Netherlands. And then early company form. The first company that developed overseas on a sort of a powerful global basis was the Dutch East India Company. From 1609 onwards, I've actually provided a copy of an early East India Company bond going back to 1626 on the system. The UK markets then developed early forms of annuities and bond markets called consols. So we had 3% bank annuities from 1726 and 3% consols from 1751. I then explained the nature of the subsequent development of the international financial system in terms of domestic bonds. So bonds issued in the local currency, and then after the Second World War, we get the origins of the Eurodollar market, whereby we're issuing bonds in another currency other than the country of issuance. This principally was based in London, so we're initially issuing dollar bonds, so that's partly why it was called the Eurodollar market, because it was euros, it was dollars being sold in euros. Although there is actually some reference that it was actually the cable address on the fax of the telex machine of one of the first participants in the market actually said euro dollar. So we think it may actually have been a cable address. But what then would happen is this. London will then re-establish itself as the principal international financial centre, so it becomes the centre for the euro loan market and the bond market, which means you can raise any funds in any currency in the world, and so long as it's not in sterling, it's a Eurobond deal in London. But the Eurobond markets would also spread to other financial centres, Frankfurt, Shanghai, New York. If you're borrowing in any currency outside the local currency, technically that's a Eurobond deal. All of this is explained in the paper. We're then looking at bond structures and the nature of these as securities but debt instruments. The distinction between a bond and an equity is that with equity, you own a proportionate share in the value of the company as a going concern. You don't own the assets of the company, you actually own a proportionate interest, you hold a proportionate interest in the company itself. As a shareholder, you have information rights, you have voting rights, and you have dividend rights. As a bondholder, you have more limited information rights, very limited control rights, and you receive interest instead of dividend. But in practice, companies and financial institutions, and banks in particular, much prefer bondholders to shareholders, and they will issue massive amounts of bonds, and you will always see the balance sheet stacked with very large amounts of bonds rather than with equity. The key core principal terms of the bond are then almost identical to the loan issue. The only difference is drawdown tends to be simpler. So we need to look at the amount, we need to look at the term, and we need to look at the interest payments. We need to consider the form, we need to consider the parties, we need to consider the documentation, and then any other ancillary and additional provisions, and I explain all that in the paper. I've also specifically looked at different types of structures, different types of deals, which I explain. So you'll see in here, we can use different types of format with, for example, private placements, preliminary prospectus offerings, or impact day offerings. Very often, deals are now pre-priced, they're open-priced, and they're bought deals, whereby the lead bank will undertake to assume responsibility for the sale of the whole issue into the market. The arranging bank will have large numbers of contacts, it will have specialist selling divisions inside its own corporate structure, it will be able to place the bonds very simply, very easily into the market. So long as it's not beyond a certain size, most large arranging banks will enter into bought deals whereby they take on the whole issue and then they can sell it straight into the market. That's where it's a private bond type of deal. In other cases, if it's, for example, government gilts in the United Kingdom or treasury bills in the United States. There'll be a separate, usually an auction market, which actually is managed by either the central bank itself or a separate department on behalf of the central bank. So what do we need? We need to consider the mandate. The issuer will initially obtain a mandate to enter into the transaction. It will issue the mandate to the arranging bank to give the late arranging bank authority to put the... We sometimes call this the syndicate again, although it's a different type of syndicate. You'll see in some of the papers, some of the diagrams, some of the discussion, they talk about syndication as being part of the timeline process. It's a different type of syndication. It simply means appointing parties, bringing parties together, drafting the documentation, entering into the documentation. So the arranging bank, once it's completed all of the early stages, which includes the mandate letter, includes any conflicts of interest, agreeing the fees, we will then begin to agree the terms. A parallel system operates in the capital market deal as to the loan deal. We have the term sheet, which will be issued in a loan deal, so that we have the mandate letter. The information memorandum sets out all of the details with regards to the issuing company, its business, its subsidiaries, its use and application of the funds and prospects to repay the funds. In the bond deal, that becomes the prospectus or the listing particulars, if we're also going to list so we can sell to the general public. And then we'll go for admission. We can have admission to listing and then separately admission to stock markets and exchanges. So we'll have the loan deal, we have the mandate letter, the information memorandum and the loan agreement with the summary of the provisions which are going to be included in the loan agreement set out in the term sheet. We do something very similar in the bond deal. You'll see that here. We're going to have an invitation telex, which is going to summarise the key provisions, so it parallels the term sheet in the loan deal. So the telex, invitation telex, will set out, for example, ratings, guarantees, negative pledges, early redemption, sales restrictions, stabilisation, cross default, any force majeure provisions. If it's a bought deal, we can pre-price it, we can agree the coupon and the price with the amount, and then whether we're going to issue at par, which is face value, or at a discount, or at a premium. And all of this will be agreed between the issuer and the investment bank. We're then going to draft all of the documentation. All of the key documents I summarised in the separate tables and diagrams presentations provided. We're going to need to have the subscription agreement. That's the core document that's entered into between the lead manager or the managers and the issuing company, which undertakes to set up the issuance and ensure that the bonds are sold into the market. We will have a trust deed if there's a separate trustee. We'll have a selling group agreement if the separate selling agents have to be appointed. We'll also have a separate underwriting agreement if we need underwriters. The underwriters confirm that they will undertake any amounts that cannot be sold by the selling group. In very large issues, you'll have both a selling group and an underwriting group. If we have a trustee, we only then need a paying agent. The trustee acts on behalf of the bond holders. The paying agent acts on behalf of the issuer. If there's no trustee, we'll have a fiscal agent, not a paying agent. So we have the fiscal agency agreement, which will also create a trust to ensure that any amounts held by the agent on behalf of bondholders are held in trust as well to protect their interests. We will prepare all of the draft documentation. The key paper will then become the prospectus. As we've said, this parallels the information memorandum in the loan deal. This explains the nature of the issuer's business, corporate structure, as well as use and application of the funds and how the bonds will be repaid over time. Again, as I've said already, the prospectus can also be called the offering circular. It will also become the listing particulars if we're going for listing, which means we're selling to the general public, and then we'll also use the listing particulars as part of the application if we want to sell through a particular stock exchange. So we have to become admitted to listing as well as to admission to trading on a specific stock exchange, such as the London Stock Exchange, Luxembourg, or New York or Brussels. We will agree all the core terms, including the key financials, the amount, whether we're issuing at par, premium or discount, and then the coupon rate. We'll then have the signing. When we exchange documents, we'll then have the final closing, where we exchange any residual documents, as well as technically the arranging bank makes provision for the total payment amount to be received by the issuer, for example, $100 million or $1 billion or $5 billion, in exchange for the bonds. In practice, we will not issue all of the definitive bonds immediately. It takes time to print those, unless we're going to dematerialise. If we're going to print, we will then immobilise. So we deposit them with the custodians, Euroclear or Clearstream. In terms of more modern practice, we will simply now dematerialise, which means we issue them in an electronic form, and they're held by Euroclear and Clearstream. Euroclear in Brussels, Clearstream in Luxembourg. There will usually, even if we're dematerialising, be a technical 40-day lockdown period. This is principally required under the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act 1982, the TEFRA in the United States, whereby the arranging bank needs to confirm to the American authorities that the bonds will not be sold to an American citizen anywhere in the world, in America or abroad, or that if they are, they comply with the relevant requirements imposed under the Securities Act 1933 or Securities and Exchange Act 1934. So we still have this 40-day lockdown period. Technically, during that period, there is only one bond, a temporary global bond, which is an instrument sui generis in law. It's not legally a bond, it's not legally anything, it's just a completely unique document which represents cumulatively all of the value and rights and obligations of all of the potential investors, all of their interests in the bond. That's going to operate only for this limited period. It will then be replaced by the definitive bonds or the definitive technical issues, which is set up under the dematerialised programme. We also have to consider what's called dealing and stabilisation. This is whereby we're going to manage the price during the period from the public announcement till the actual closing and the bonds are made available into the market. What happens is from the initial announcement, we get what we call a grey market. There's a grey market which immediately develops so you can buy and sell the bonds even before they're issued. The problem is that the arrangers, the managers, need to ensure that the grey market dealings, that effectively secondary dealings in the bonds before they're sold, do not impact the price of the bonds on the closing. So what can actually happen is, although this would otherwise be illegal, the managers can actually try to manipulate the price. We call this stabilisation. So they can be involved in this grey market and they can actually attempt to stabilise the price. While that would normally be contrary to laws, to financial laws and securities laws, it's legal if it's provided for this purpose alone. We also then have to manage the allotments. And the allotments, the specific provisions on this in the main handbook, which is the International Capital Markets Association, ICMA, handbook, which deals on, sets out all of the court conditions for the primary issuance of bonds and other note programmes in the primary market, which is where we bring the bonds to the market for the first time. There's a large number of rules and provisions set out in the handbook. It effectively operates on a rules basis rather than a model document basis, because they found that was simpler and easier to operate in the capital market area. In the loan situation, whereby you only have one document, the loan agreement, and then in the derivatives area, where we have a single master agreement, it's much easier to deal with this, the documentation itself, but they found out it operates in practice much more effectively to determine this through rules set out in the ICMA handbook. There will be specific provisions on allotments. The problem with allotments is this. The banks that are participating in the grey market want to buy and sell and set a price before the bonds have come to the market. But the main uncertainty is that they do not know how much bonds they'll actually receive. So they will maybe bid or try to consider and set up the pricing on the basis of a pre-allotment figure, but they don't actually know if they're going to receive those bonds. So there's specific rules with regards to allotments and pre-allotments and how much dealers and brokers in the market should receive subsequently, depending upon any earlier pre-allotment terms and conditions that were set out. The trust deed in a large issue is to appoint a trustee to act on behalf of the bondholders, and the trustee will arrange bondholders' meetings. The agent bank, either the paying agent or the fiscal agent, is agent on behalf of the issuer. The trustee is agent, trustee on behalf of the bondholders. We then have listing. Just on the trust deed will be the largest document by far. A lot of these documents may only be 20 pages, 40 pages at most, possibly only 10 pages, 5 pages, 6 pages. The trust deed could be 200-400 pages. It's usually the document that you get at the end of the deal, and you just have to sit and read it. It's not very pleasant, but it's one part of the larger due diligence process. As a young associate in a large law firm, you will have to read this. It will be 200-300 pages. And then it's a question of to what extent you have to try and make or negotiate any revisions and terms and conditions. In practice, most of this is complete standard practice. So all the major law firms operating in London and in the other main financial centres, they have all their own standard documents, and as you do these deals, you become very familiar with them. So depending upon who's the main law firm acting for the arranging bank, you will know immediately, weeks in advance, it's going to be their trust deed or their subscription agreement. So you will actually very quickly, you know exactly what's coming and you know what's going to be in there. So you will also be ready with your own revision points and any technical revisions, any technical negotiation points which have to be discussed. You will probably spend least time actually negotiating, trying to change the trust deed, because it's very often in standard terms, but it will be 200-300 pages and you need to go through it. Listing, as we've already mentioned, to be admitted to listing is to obtain permission to sell to the general public. But you also have separate admission to be sold on a specific stock exchange. So there's two forms of admission. If you're not going to sell to the general public, if it's a private placement or it's only being sold to a small, limited, restricted group, you don't trigger listing, you don't trigger the securities laws, so you don't have to consider that. Very often, even if you're not going to sell the bonds on a specific stock market and exchange, and I discussed this in the text, you may still want it to be listed. Because certain institutional investors who are going to purchase the bonds, such as insurance companies, are restricted in the extent to which they can only buy listed paper or non-listed. So if you want a wide extended market, even if you don't intend to have it listed on a specific stock market exchange, you still apply for listing, because it opens up the investor base that can purchase this. And then we have the closing. So any other conditions precedent have to be satisfied, and you'll exchange the temporary global for the actual amount involved. You have the 40-day lockdown, after which the definitive notes replace the temporary global, and then you have the final completion of everything after the 40-day lockdown period. I discuss in the paper the nature of negotiability. There's a number of very important, very famous English cases in this area: Goodwin versus Roberts, Gurney versus Berend, Darrell versus Hall. Negotiability is determined by the market. If the market considers that a specific issue is negotiable, the courts will recognise that. It's not the courts who decide whether it's negotiable, the markets decide, and the courts simply recognise market practice. And that's all confirmed in the practice there. Picker versus London and County, per Lord Isher and Lord Bowen, and then Buchanan Land and Edelstein versus Schuller. I explained, summarised all the key case law in this area, as well as the other key provisions which apply in determining whether and what factors we're looking at. Principally, it's to do with the volume and frequency of the issuance. If the market regards it as being negotiable, the courts will give effect to that. I also then mentioned the governing law provisions that will apply with regards to bonds. The paper considers the nature of clearing. It looks at the work and role of Euroclear and Clearstream. and their involvement in this and how they actually hold and protect the bonds, basically through immobilisation. Clearstream was set up by J.P. Morgan in 1968. So Euroclear was established by J.P. Morgan in 1968 in Brussels. Clearstream was originally created as Sidel in 1970 and subsequently renamed Clearstream. It's now owned by Deutsche Börse. All of the functions of the custodians are explained in the paper, including with regards to the nature of the temporary global bond. The bond structures themselves, we have euro bonds, which are the plain vanilla bonds, which are the most commonly issued instruments in practice, but we've also got various types of other instrument that we can issue. So we have zero coupon bonds, foreign currency bonds, reserve, dual currency bonds, first coupon and partly paid bonds, currency change bonds, and annuity bonds. On floating rate notes, notes have floating rate interest rather than fixed interest on the bonds. Again, a whole series of variations. We can have 4FRNs, drop locks, double drop locks, caps, collars, mini-maxes, inverses, bull reverse FRNs, all these different variations. Other interest rate options include, for example, bunny bonds or lobos and bolos. I explain all of these in the text, all of these in the footnotes. On other interest rate possibilities, choice variation, we have graduated rate bonds, deferred coupon bonds, profit sharing bonds, index bonds, dual bonds. We can have perpetual instruments, which will be issued for an indefinite period, and again, large number of different types of options. Perpetuals, put options, puts and calls, extendables, retractables, step-ups, step-downs, sinking funds, purchase funds. On redemption, we can have different choices. We can have bullet bonds, annuities, as well as other variations on currency, foreign currency, dual currency, heaven and hells, capped heaven and hells, reverse heaven and hells, bull bears, index linked, commodity linked, S&P 500 linked, convertibles and flip-flops. It's a whole series of different options that we can create. The whole point simply is this: you pre-design the nature of the instrument and the rights and obligations of the parties up front. You don't have the same flexibility that you would have in a loan deal once you've had the closing and the signing. You can do anything for 20 years afterwards depending upon the express terms of the agreement. All of this has to be preset, all of this has to be pre-designed, all of this has to be pre-built in to the instrument you're issuing. That's why you have all these different variations. Warrants allow you to buy something of the same value at a fixed time in the future. And then you can have equity linked bonds as well. Medium term notes tend to be for medium terms between 5, 10, up to 15 years. I explained the background to these and the historical development and origin of these with some of the other variations. The euro notes are shorter instruments. Some of the books will say this goes down to 1 year, anything between 5, 3, 2 down to 1. I have seen references whereby the euro notes can be less than 1 year, which overlaps with the commercial paper market. But then in the text, I explain the difference between the euro note market and the commercial paper market. That's in the text there. Essentially due to the nature of the underwriting, whether it's committed, the terms of settlement. If it's larger, underwritten, committed, it can be a euro note, or you can also issue that in the form of commercial paper. All of this is explained in the paper. I then look at certificates of deposit and then multi-option funding facilities, MOFs and MOFFs. The point simply is this: if you're trying to give your client maximum flexibility, maximum opportunity, you would recommend them off. If you're going capital market rather than loan market, unless there's a specific need for a particular instrument, you recommend them off. That's the default position because it's a combination of other instruments. So, for example, we can have short-term multi-advances, medium-term note program, euro and domestic commercial paper program, bankers' acceptances, and a swing line facility. A swing line is simply a temporary overdraft, a temporary lending to allow you to move funds between other facilities. That's all that's for. And then the rest of the paper just finishes up by looking at the nature of domestic markets. So we'll get the domestic debenture markets, bond markets, gilt markets, so UK gilt stocks and bonds, gilt edge securities, local authority stocks, public sector bonds, and then the US Treasury Agency, the municipal bond market. And then we've got other Japanese bond markets, German government bond markets, all of the different types of instruments in Germany, Bundesobligationen, Kassenobligationen, Bundesschatzbriefe, the Pfandbriefe, other types of government securities. And then finally, we've got the corporate bond market. Companies can also issue bonds, UK debentures and loan stock, US corporate bonds, Japanese bond market, and then other foreign bonds, and then other bond variants. All of the different types of instruments, all of the different structures and obligations, and rights and entitlements of all of the parties are set out in the paper. This is one of the most important funding markets in the world. It's something that we need to understand as part of this larger study of international finance and the international financial markets and finance system.